Hey, Novena.
Yes, Michael?
Got a couple of questions for you. And the first is a very LA kind of question.
Okay.
Okay, so first off, let's imagine you've got a nice clear drive on the freeway of your choice. No delays, no traffic.
So this is a fantasy.
Or, you know, it's hella late at night. But the question is, what do you have on your stereo?
Ooh, okay. Favorite driving music.
Mm-hmm.
I really dig coasting along to the music of Beach House.
Oh, nice.
They sound like wide open roads, warm winds, and nostalgia. And they allow my mind to drift into imagination land.
Oh, I love that. They're so dreamy sounding.
Yes.
Such a good choice.
What about you?
Oh, man, you know, there's so many.
Mm-hmm.
But probably my absolute favorite driving music got to be the Mizell Brothers.
Oh, yes. I love them, too. So good.
Just perfect for cruising around town. You mind if I play one of their songs right now? I mean, it's literally about driving.
Oh, my God. Yes. Let me guess. Hmm? Harlem River Drive.
That's right. From Bobby Humphrey's album Blacks and Blues. But that sound is all Larry and Fonce Mizell.
Let's start the engine.
Yeah.
Such a classic sound. All those rich, lush arrangements. Mm. And that shuffling groove in there. And those soft and soulful vocals. Michael, so good.
Ooh, so good. But now, here comes the second question.
Okay.
Did you know that virtually all of those classic Mizell Brothers productions were recorded right here in Los Angeles?
I did. Ooh. And not just that, but all at one place.
Mm-hmm.
The Sound Factory in Hollywood. But I don't know how much other folks realize that.
Yeah, it's a trip, right? You know, so much of the Mizell Brothers' music is tied to specific places. Harlem River Drive, San Francisco Lights,
mm-hmm.
Chicago, damn, New York Times, Jasper County Man. But none of the music they released directly references Los Angeles, even though all of it was recorded here.
Before it ever made it to the Sound Factory, the brothers had been working out the tunes in their own home studio, a kind of hidden oasis for them up in the Hollywood Hills.
Mm. And now, you know, I think it's time we make sure everyone knows LA's connection to the sound, as well as how the Mizells ended up here. It's an amazing story that involves Motown, rocket science, and a classic model Porsche sports car.
A perfect tale for this season of Lost Notes from KCRW.
Oh, yeah.
I'm Novena Carmel.
And I'm Michael Barnes.
And on this episode of Lost Notes, we're going to take you on a journey through the places and spaces of the legendary Mizell Brothers.
Alfonso and Lawrence Mizell, also known as Fonce and Larry, spent their early years in the Sugar Hill neighborhood of Harlem. Matter of fact, they lived just up the hill from Harlem River Drive on Edgecombe Avenue, a street which once counted Thurgood Marshall, W.E.B. Du Bois, Count Basie, and Benny Carter among its residents.
When Larry and Fonce were in middle school, the family moved from Harlem to Englewood, New Jersey. There, they met Freddie Perren, an aspiring musician who was close to Fonce's age. Freddie, Fonce, and Larry went on to attend Dwight Morrow High School, where they were mentored by the school's band director, Thaddeus Kropczynski. Thaddeus arranged for Larry and Fonce to rent trumpets for a few bucks a week so they could play in the band.
Back home, they shared a duplex with their parents and their younger brother, Rodney. Their grandparents lived in the unit next door, where they had an upright piano, which their grandmother could play by ear, although really only the black keys. The boys' enduring fascination with the instrument eventually led their mom to rent a baby grand piano of their own. In school, they had an ensemble called the Jazz Pipers, which included their friend Freddie Perren and also their French teacher, who would sometimes sit in to recite poetry over their music. They also sang in doo-wop groups, including one called the Nikons. And while there aren't any recordings from this period of time, if you fast forward to the 1970s, it's clear that doo-wop had a major influence on the ways that Larry, Fonce, and Freddie harmonized and sang on many of their classic 1970s records. Thank you.
And one memory from their time growing up in Jersey stuck in Larry's mind. He had a part-time job in high school, and one day his boss took him out for a spin in his Porsche 356 sports car. Larry remembered the incredible handling of that car and how it could make 90-degree turns on a dime. It left him with a feeling he couldn't quite put his finger on, but it was one that would come back to him years later.
That is such a beautiful memory. Although I doubt all of their memories growing up in Englewood, New Jersey during this time were as sweet. Fonts, Freddie, and Larry graduated from Morrow High in 1961, the same year that a lawsuit was filed by several black families against the Englewood Board of Education, accusing them of a combination of deliberate and de facto segregation in the city's schools. You have to remember, this was only 7 years after the landmark Brown versus Board of Education decision. Many places in the U.S., and Englewood in particular, were not prioritizing efforts around school desegregation.
Yeah, and one can only imagine how the boys handled the transition from a predominantly black neighborhood like Sugar Hill to a city with Englewood's integration problems. Mm-hmm. And it might also explain why Fonts, Freddie, and Larry chose to enroll at Howard University, one of the country's largest and most preeminent historically black colleges and universities.
Upon arriving at Howard that fall in 1961, they heard about the university's homecoming talent show, which was rumored to be the hottest event on campus. So they put together a vocal quartet called the Van Lords with their friend John Butler. Despite the fact that they were only freshmen, they won the show, making them instant stars around campus. And they went on to clean house at other talent shows around town as well.
A few years later, in 1964, they came across a freshman playing his butt off, as Larry says, on a piano in the rehearsal rooms. He turned out to be Donnie Hathaway, a kid from St. Louis who was studying music at Howard on a fine arts scholarship. Donnie became an honorary member of the Van Lords, sitting in with them at shows on occasion. Although he wouldn't stick around to finish his degree before his own career came calling.
To be a hung, gifted, and black. Oh, what a lovely, precious dream.
Now that the Mizells and Freddie Perren had a successful group, they figured the next step was to start their own record label. Larry came up with the name Hog Records, after a slang term for a Cadillac. Fonts found three singers from nearby Morgan State University in Baltimore, whom they named The Moments. They booked the group into Edgewood Studios in Washington, D.C., at a cost of about $25, or $250 in today's money. A few Howard undergrads came on board as a backing band, along with some string players from the Air Force Band, and also a few Alpha Kappa Alpha sorority girls on backing vocals.
If I see what I want, I'm gonna get it.
What I want,
I'm gonna get you.
Baby, baby,
my baby, my baby.
Oh, my baby.
Baby, 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 I want you.
But the trouble was, they had no idea how to market the record. So the Mizells ended up sitting on a pile of copies of records they couldn't sell. Eventually, kind of like Tainted Love, the song found an audience in those all-nighters of the Northern Soul scene, and now those 45s fetch a pretty penny. Larry has even said how much he wished he held on to more of them.
I bet.
Yeah. But his first experience recording in a studio environment absolutely captivated the brothers. And from that experience, Larry and Fonts decided they were better suited to writing and production rather than running a record label.
Now, as you might expect, Fonts and Freddie were enrolled in the music department at Howard, but Larry was working toward his bachelor's in engineering. Like so many other young folks of the time, he was fascinated by the space program. But unlike many of those folks, Larry actually had the talent and the training to turn it into a career. After graduation, he decided that he wanted to work on the cutting edge of the aerospace industry. He got an interview at Grumman Aerospace on Long Island, the company that held a contract with NASA to build the Apollo Lunar Module.
And while Larry was waiting in Grumman's lobby for an interview, he ran into the head of the microelectronics division, Edward Kianjin. After talking with Larry for a few minutes, Kianjin invited him to apply to his division instead and hired him almost immediately. And from there, Larry worked on the lunar module while pursuing his master's in engineering at NYU. On the weekends, though, he shed his suit and tie and settled into a more familiar role, playing in three or four bands around town.
While Larry was off literally working on rockets, Fonts was finishing up his fine arts degree at Howard. Jazz trumpet player Donald Byrd arrived at Howard in 1968 to establish their jazz studies program. Fonts was one of Byrd's earliest students, and Larry would also come down from time to time to attend Byrd's lectures. Larry recalls that Byrd wasn't that focused on teaching the music theory side of things. He was more interested in teaching these kids about the practicalities of being a successful working musician out in the world. And from their time in class together, Fonts and Byrd established a relationship that would serve them both well in the coming years.
After graduating in June of 1969, one of Fonts's professors told him about a relative out in L.A. who was starting a new label called the Los Angeles Recording Company, or LARCO. Freddie Perren had already moved out that way, trying to catch a break, so Fonts decided to pack up and join him. Donald Byrd got word that Fonts was heading to L.A., so he put in a call with Deke Richards. Deke was an expat from Detroit who had moved to L.A. to work with Motown in their new West Coast office. He invited Fonts and Freddie to the Motown offices for a meeting, and they were canny enough to bring Deke a demo tape with a few of their songs. That tape very quickly made its way to Berry Gordy.
Mm-hmm. At that time, Gordy was still smarting from his legal battle with Holland Dozier Holland, the hit-making team who penned a long list of Motown classics before breaking ranks with the company in 1967. Gordy was now very wary of any more of what he called backroom superstars joining the company. So in 1969, he created a new entity called the Corporation, who would write and produce anonymously on Motown's behalf. Deke Richards was the creative director of the corporation, and he invited Fonts and Freddie to become part of the team. Rounding out the corporation was Berry Gordy himself.
The new group's first assignment was a song for Gladys Knight called I Wanna Be Free. But the night before the recording, Gordy called and said that he was changing the assignment. Instead of Gladys, the song would be recorded by a new family group from Gary, Indiana. He told the corporation to come up with a different lyrical concept and to change the key to something more suited to young men's voices. Fonts and Freddie were disappointed about missing out on Gladys Knight for a bunch of kids. But they showed up at the studio the next day with the revised number, which was now called I Want You Back.
Recorded in August of 1969, I Want You Back went on to become the first of four consecutive number one singles by the Jackson Five, the next two of which, ABC and The Love You Save, were also written by the corporation. And suddenly, Fonts and Freddie were already at the center of Motown's hit-making machine.
Meanwhile, as the 60s moved into the 70s, Larry was enjoying his success at Grumman, traveling to Europe for conferences and publishing his own research. But he was feeling called back to the music, especially after hearing about Fonts and Freddie's massive success at Motown. And Fonts was constantly asking him to come out and join them in L.A. So once he finished his master's degree at NYU, Larry gave his notice at Grumman and answered his brother's call at last.
Just as Larry arrived, Fonts' work with Motown and the corporation was winding down. By 1972, none of the Jackson 5's recent hits had been written by the team. Hal Davis, who was head of Motown's West Coast operation, had taken over as the Jackson 5's new producer-in-chief.
And this gave the space for the brothers to get back together again as a working unit outside of the corporation. Fonts and Larry scored their first Motown credit by getting a song placed on the Jackson 5's seventh album, Skyrider. And shortly thereafter, in the summer of 1972, Motown came calling on behalf of another major artist.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Marvin Gaye was feeling creatively restless after the massive success of What's Going On. He'd been working on scattered sessions in Los Angeles and Detroit, but nothing was taking shape. So in order to help things along, the label invited other producers in the Motown family to submit tracks for Marvin's consideration, including the Mizells.
The brothers sent in three songs to Motown. And in the end, all three were selected. Marvin and the Mizells got together in the studio in July of 1972. But only two of the three songs were finished before Marvin abandoned the project to turn his attention to the soundtrack for the movie Trouble Man.
The two tracks they did complete were called Where Are We Going and Woman of the World. And although these tracks circulated on bootlegs for decades, they weren't released commercially until the 21st century. But thank goodness we didn't lose these recordings to time, because they are amazing and surely would have been hits if released at that time.
Tell me where I'm going. What's the future show? Oh, where are we hanging? With all that's going on, where are we getting? Woo!
This may have been the last straw for Larry and Fonts as far as Motown was concerned. Between feeling squeezed out of the Jackson 5 and being left high and dry on the Marvin Project, it seems like it was time for them to take back more control over their creative work.
That opportunity would come sooner than they might have expected. As it happens, just a few months earlier, the brothers had gotten a call from their old mentor, Donald Byrd, who was looking for a new sound. Larry and Fonts then worked up a pair of tracks with Byrd as part of a planned collaboration, Flight Time and Mr. Thomas, but had been radio silent since then. However, just as the Motown situation was winding down, Byrd called back with good news. His label, Blue Note, had finally cleared them to resume work on the album.
And that record would become the Mizells' first opportunity to really stretch out and show what they could do. Byrd's previous album, Ethiopian Nights, was a fusion effort that ventured into hard funk and atmospheric grooves. But for this new record, he handed over the creative keys entirely to the Mizell brothers. It was a gesture of absolute confidence on the part of their former mentor and really gave them the chance to truly take flight.
And as all this is happening, arguably at the exact perfect moment, they found their own little slice of paradise in Los Angeles. In June of 1972, the brothers found a three-bedroom property up a private drive in the Hollywood Hills with a street address right on Hollywood Boulevard. Like most of the homes in the neighborhood, it was a split-level house built right into the hill.
The lower deck overlooked a swimming pool to open out over the canyon, revealing a picture-perfect panoramic view of the city, trailing off to Santa Monica in the distance. At night, as LA's giant grid of lights blinked on after dusk, the cars on La Cienega Boulevard made a perfect seam of light down the middle. The brothers suddenly had an almost mythical view of Los Angeles right out their backyard. And what they really wanted was the house to become their sanctuary, a place where they could rise above LA's easy distractions and get back to basics, making music together. So they turned the bedroom off the deck into their jam studio. Every inch of it was packed with instruments, a drum set, guitars, bass guitars, a piano, and an array of synthesizers.
And from there, the Mizells passed their days riding high on pure inspiration. They'd get together and jam, picking up instruments at random, playing off one another, with a Sony tape recorder always running in case they stumble across the perfect riff or melody. On any given day, one of them might get a chord progression stuck in their head and jump into the studio, and the other might hear it from some distant part of the house and be drawn into the room by what they were hearing.
And this wasn't a party house or a bachelor pad. They didn't even have group jam sessions. The house was strictly devoted to the musical synergy that the Mizells shared. And that was true whether they were writing for a specific project or just playing for pleasure. It was an auspicious place to begin writing and working out this new Donald Byrd album, which would eventually be called Blackbird.
And now that Larry was living in a city with such a vibrant car culture, an old memory came flooding back to him. He thought of that high school boss and the thrill of riding in his Porsche 356. And now that both brothers had the means, they bought their own pair of sweet black Porsche 911S convertibles, which were indeed perfect for handling those tight, narrow turns up in the hills. It was the fulfillment of a youthful dream. And when we talked to Larry about this time, he remembers feeling absolute gratitude for what they achieved.
The location of their home was perfect in more practical ways, too. It was just a short drive down the canyon to all the recording studios in Hollywood. They'd make home demos on their four-track tape machine, recording all the parts themselves, and then they'd take those demos down to the recording studio to play for the musicians. For their charts and sheet music, the Mizells contracted with a company called the Bob Ross Music Service, not that Bob Ross, who would pick up the handwritten notes from their mailbox at 6 or 7 in the morning and turn around sheet music in time for the session to start at 11 a.m.
For the recording of Blackbird, the Mizells put together something like a house band, not dissimilar to L.A.'s famous Wrecking Crew, featuring Wilton Felder and Joe Sample of the Crusaders, as well as musicians who would feature on multiple Mizell productions in the future, such as Harvey Mason, Chuck Rainey, King Arison, Roger Glenn, and of course, their longtime friend Freddie Perren. These were players who could work in a jazz idiom, but who also had backgrounds in soul, funk, pop, and blues. And while the brothers had arrangements in mind, worked out from those cassettes and sheets of music, they also trusted their players to work as a unit. They encouraged the musicians to find pockets of creativity and to explore the vibe of the music together. As a result, the sessions took on a family atmosphere with jams that would extend until the final seconds before the tape ran out. But once the songs found their shape, they called Byrd out from New York to work out his parts. Mizell's demos themselves were hugely important for conveying the feel of what they wanted. And this may be one reason why those Mizell records always felt like they came from the same musical universe, even when the headline artists were different. They wrote their tunes for themselves first and foremost, and never built their sound around somebody else's ideas. Those classic records came directly out of their experience of living and vibing with one another up in the hills.
Equally important to the arrangements was the sound of the records themselves. And for that, the Mizells landed in the perfect studio to help them put their ideas on tape. The Sound Factory was located at 6357 Selma Avenue. It was owned by Dave Hassinger, who was Motown's house engineer in Los Angeles until they could finish building their own Mo West studios. Hassinger had a staff engineer named Val Garay, who had been working with Fonts on projects at the Sound Factory since the early days of the corporation. With all these connections, the Sound Factory became part of that same family atmosphere that imprinted itself on their most iconic productions.
The Sound Factory also had an incredible array of gear, some of which became the bedrock of the classic Mizell Brothers sound. This included the Fender Rhodes piano, the Hohner Clavinet D6, the Mini Moog, and a pair of ARP synthesizers, the Odyssey, and the Selena String Ensemble. The Selena in particular was making a splash as a way for producers to replicate the sound of string sections without having to deal with the time and expense of hiring one. At the end of the day, the sound it made was not a one-to-one match for a real string ensemble, but it had a distinctive and quirky sound which contributed to the unique texture of the Mizell's productions.
According to Larry, there was initially considerable ambivalence at Blue Note about how this sound fit in with Donald Byrd's previous work. At one point, he says they weren't even sure the label wanted to release it, but the collaboration proved to be wildly successful on almost every front, musically, creatively, and especially commercially. Blackbird became Blue Note's greatest selling release of all time up to that point. It sold over 100,000 copies within the first 6 weeks. The album made it to number 2 on the jazz charts, and the title track became a breakout single, cracking the R&B top 20 and even the Hot 100 pop chart. It served as a vindication of the brothers' confidence, imagination, and mastery in the studio.
The success of Blackbird led to further collaborations with Donald Byrd, and after its release, there was suddenly a long line of jazz artists and their record labels who were hungry for the same success. The Mizells went on to produce iconic albums for flute player Bobby Humphrey, organist Johnny Hammond Smith, and sax player Gary Bartz. And while they kept a foot in the pop world with records by The Miracles, The Jackson 5, and Edwin Starr's soundtrack to Hell Up in Harlem, 1973 to 1977 was an extraordinarily productive period of creation for the Mizells, producing no less than 13 albums in that short period of time. And each and every one of them began with ideas the brothers created in their Hollywood home, a true musical sanctuary.
Music speaks to all.
It's so dear to us.
Music makes us think.
It's so mysterious.
Music is my sanctuary. Music is my life. Music is my sanctuary. Music is my life. Music makes you smile.
It's optimistical.
It can make you sad.
It's so lyrical.
Music is my sanctuary. Music is my life. Music is my sanctuary. Music is my life.
But Byrd and the Mizells came up hard against the notoriously conservative jazz press, a.k.a. the jazz police. Mostly white and always male, they were not having Byrd's new direction. In the Calgary Herald, avant-garde musician Eugene Chadbourne fumed.
Who is Larry Mizell and what does he know about Donald Byrd? Byrd, who has a PhD, by the way, has written material miles above Mizell's pap.
Jeff Simon of the Buffalo Evening News said,
Byrd's hit formula, and formula it is to play a little update neo bebop on top of a rock rhythm section and hope for the best.
Downbeat magazine, as close to a paper of record as jazz ever had, skipped out on even reviewing it altogether.
On and on throughout the 1970s. Critics sharpened their knives every time a Mizell production came down the pike. But Larry says that neither he nor Fonz ever thought what they were doing is jazz music in the purest sense. They sometimes called it instrumental funk when asked, but mostly, they just wanted to make music they were into. And thankfully, for those who fell in love with their music, fell in love to their music, played it at family gatherings and barbecues, danced to it in clubs or living rooms or at skating rinks, the Mizell brothers just didn't let what the critics had to say affect what they produced.
A pretty baby, dry eyes, don't you know it can't be that bad? How it hurts my pretty baby when I see you sitting there so sad. Don't need to worry about tomorrow, and yesterday is gone. So raise the chin up, girl, and we will work our problems out one by one.
Hold me tight, don't let go. Turn me loose, never no, no, no. We'll stand our problems all in a row.
them fall like dominoes.
In 1976, Larry and Fonce's 19-year-old brother Rodney joined them in L.A., and he immediately became part of those family jam sessions up on the hill. He also jumped headfirst into their commercial work. He co-wrote three songs on the brothers' final collaboration with Donald Byrd, Caricatures. And when the Mizells began working with a 10-piece soul outfit called LTD, Rodney co-wrote half the songs on their breakout album, Love to the World.
After all the success they'd achieved with their signature sound, the making of the LTD album became a greater fiasco than the Mizells were ever used to. First of all, after two unsuccessful albums, LTD was already deeply in debt to their label, A&M Records. So the label hired the Mizells in a last-ditch effort to turn the group's fortunes around, and LTD's lead singer, Billy Osborne, he just could not shake his resentment over that arrangement. And as for the Mizells, they most definitely were not used to working with such a large group of musicians from outside the family, so to speak.
The dam finally broke when the Mizells presented the group with Love Ballad, a song written by one of their associates, Skip Scarborough. Billy hated the song and stormed out of the studio in a huff, leaving his brother Jeff behind. Jeff was technically the drummer, but the Mizells went ahead and stuck him behind the mic, and he ended up giving the band its first hit. Love Ballad went to number one on the R&B charts and cracked the top 20 in the pop charts as well. And on the basis of this reception, Jeffrey Osborne was crowned as LTD's new lead singer, and he went on to become one of the 1980s great R&B vocalists.
Love, I never knew that much.
Meanwhile, the Mizells' old pal Freddie Perren was also making waves on the disco scene. He left Motown in 1975 and moved over to Capitol Records, where another Howard alum named Larkin Arnold had set him up as a producer. Almost immediately, he started racking up hits for the Miracles, the Silvers, and Tavares, as well as doing the soundtrack for the much-cherished film Cooley High. Perren also co-wrote two massive hits for Peaches and Herb, Reunited and Shake Your Groove Thing, and he earned two back-to-back Grammys in 1978 for the Saturday Night Fever soundtrack and in 1979 for Gloria Gaynor's I Will Survive.
The Mizells themselves repeated their own hit-making magic in the producer's chair for the group A Taste of Honey, whose 1978 disco classic, Boogie Oogie Oogie, is still inescapable today.
And by this point, critics be damned. The Mizells had demonstrated their hit-making capabilities across multiple genres for years. So in 1979, Warner Brothers' Bob Krasnow invited the brothers to make their debut as recording artists in their own right under their own name. They began work on a project which was to be called simply The Mizells. Early previews of the album were received enthusiastically by the label, who then started tossing around big ideas, including a major headlining national tour.
But the brothers still maintained that the studio was their home. They wanted to keep on writing and producing behind the scenes as they always had been. So as work on the album continued to take a backseat to other projects, it became clear that they just weren't that into the idea. They arrived at an impasse with Warner Brothers, who ultimately shelved the whole thing.
While the album has never been officially released, test pressings of the album have occasionally shown up online fetching hefty sums. And two of its tracks, just from their titles, seem to suggest that the Mizell brothers' relationship with the industry at large was beginning to change. First, there's Sometimes I Want to Be Alone, which Larry says was precisely about shutting out the noise of the world and being left to write and play. And also a song called Too Close to Hollywood, which seems to give a sense of how the Mizell brothers truly were feeling as the 1970s came to a close.
After 1980, there is only one more new credit to their name, a 1981 single by former Motown superstar Mary Wells called Gigolo. And in the midst of Thriller Mania in 1984, Motown suddenly discovered a quote-unquote lost Michael Jackson track produced by the Mizells from 1973 called Farewell, My Summer Love.
But perhaps the brothers felt they'd already done everything they set out to accomplish. And life was moving along. By 1984, both Larry and Fonz had turned 40. Larry's son, Larry Jr., was nearly 10. And the brothers wanted to bring their aging parents out to California so they could enjoy something of the life they'd built there. So in October of 1984, they sold their storied home in the hills and moved the family out to Altadena, far away from Hollywood.
But as these things go, the Mizell story was far from over. In the late 1980s, a new genre called acid jazz was bubbling up out of the UK, which took strong inspiration from the Mizells' work and translated it into a contemporary electronic sound. And you can clearly hear the influence of the Mizells in songs from groups like United Future Organization, Martin Hill, and Jamiroquai. The advent of sampling meant that their work would be continually rediscovered by a new generation. Bites from the Mizells' tracks showed up all over golden era hip-hop in the 1990s, including records by the Jungle Brothers, A Tribe Called Quest, Public Enemy, Main Source, Eric B. and Rakim, Ludacris, Diggable Planets, and Ice-T.
Additionally, more than a few neo-soul artists also clearly loved the Mizell brothers' work. Particularly Erykah Badu, whose album Mama's Gun, produced by the Soulquarians crew, borrowed heavily from their work with Johnny Hammond, not once, but twice, both uncredited, which still perplexes Larry to this day. The track Booty lifts the tune Gambler's Life more or less wholesale for its rhythm, and the song Times a Wastin' clearly samples Can't We Smile from the album Gears. Now, I know it was all love, but like I tell my students, cite your sources! Love for the Mizell brothers sound continues on into the 21st century, with samples by Madlib, Kendrick Lamar, and Tyler, the Creator. There were even rumors of a new Madlib collaboration with the Mizells in the mid-2000s, but it never came to fruition. Larry's last released track, at least at this moment, is Play With The Changes, a collaboration with electronic duo 4Hero from 2006.
Even if all this latter-day rediscovery had never happened, the Mizells' place in history was already secure. Larry Mizell's scientific research had literally made it to the distant reaches of outer space, and his brother Fonz had touched eternity as part of the corporation and their immortal work for the Jackson 5. But there is a highly specific and highly local magic to the music they made together. And to many, it will always represent the sound of Los Angeles in the 1970s.
Absolutely. And as we close up this story, we want you to consider the title track of Donald Byrd's Places and Spaces and try to imagine all the things that title conjures. Their youth spent in Harlem and Jersey, their time at Howard University, coming to Los Angeles and working with Motown, all of the music they created here, especially in that house nestled in the Hollywood Hills, with that large bedroom packed with musical instruments, overlooking a city still in the prime of its legend. And out in the driveway, two black Porsches, one for each brother, to hug the curves of Hollywood Boulevard, collecting all the stardust shedding off of the streetlights.
And the dream of a perfect sound, rich with texture and lush with melody, cascading down the canyon into the master control booth at the Sound Factory. In the golden era of Larry and Fonts Maisel from 1972 to 1979, there was no better dream in town.
Amen. Lost Notes is a KCRW original production. It's made by Michael Barnes, Ashley Brown, Novena Carmel, Melissa Duenas, and Mike Dodge Weisskopf. You can read up on this and other episodes at kcrw.com/lostnotes, including some reproductions of Larry Mizell's original space research.
Special thanks to Gina Delvac, Jennifer Farrow, Ray Guarna, Natalie Hill, Anne Litt, Sue Margulies, Arnie Seipel, Desmond Taylor, and Anthony Valadez.
Extra special thanks this week to Eothan Alapat of Now Again Records, Jeff Chang, Val Garay, Andrew Lajero, Ali Shaheed Mohammed, and Adrian Young of Jazz is Dead, Derek and Chris Perrin, Torsten Schmidt, Oliver Wong, and Dan Weisskopf.
Extra, extra, extra special thanks to Larry Mizell for generously sharing his time, memories, and photos with us and making it possible to tell this story.
This episode is dedicated to the memory of Fonts Maisel, Rodney Maisel, Freddie Perrin, and also my dear friend, Matthew Africa.
If you're still listening, drop us a line at lostnotes@kcrw.org with the name of the Maisel's college record label, and we'll send you some free swag.
I'm Michael Barnes.
And I'm Novena Carmel.
Thanks for listening.
Takes a little while.